Hello, and welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America, designed for people like you who are learning American English. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz in Washington. Every day of the year on this program, we bring you news from and about the United States and the world. Because this program is produced for learners of American English, like you, we speak a little slower than normal, and we use words and phrases that are easy to understand. Listen to the program, then practice saying the words and sentences the way we do. It's a free and easy way to improve your American English skills every day of the year. This is what you will hear on today's program. In our weekly higher education report, correspondent Pete Musto will tell us about some of the difficulties that foreign medical students face in the United States.
It's a very competitive process. Being an international medical graduate, you have less chances to be accepted because the priority would be for U.S. graduates. Having said that, it's not impossible. All what you need to do is basically early planning.
Then you will hear words and their stories, one of our most popular programs. This week, Ana Mateo will tell us about some of the many American English expressions using the word home.
A single woman living alone in her first apartment may come home after a tough day at work and sigh, "Ah, home sweet home."
And as we do every Sunday, we will present the making of a nation. Today, we will tell you about the presidential election of 1952. The winner was an army general who had helped win World War II. So you can see, as always, we have a lot for you today. So let's get started. Here's higher education correspondent Pete Musto.
International students seeking a medical degree in the United States face serious difficulties. First, there is often a language barrier. Students from non-English speaking countries could have a hard time understanding their work or communicating with professors. Also, a medical education is very costly. First, students must complete an undergraduate degree. Then, most medical schools require at least 4 years of study. After medical school, students do at least 3 more years of training in their specific medical fields. They do receive some pay for this work. In addition, many medical programs at public universities in the U.S. do not accept international students. And private universities have fewer openings, creating a great deal of competition. However, receiving a medical education in the U.S. is not impossible. Fatima Ismail is proof. The 32-year-old from Dubai says she knew she wanted to be a doctor at a very early age.
I was always fascinated with the brain and how it functions, and I love working with children. And there is a huge population of children with developmental disabilities that are not taken care of very well in Middle East in general and my home country in particular.
So, Ismail completed medical school in her home country. Then, she applied to a residency program at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, Maryland. Ismail spent time as an exchange student at Johns Hopkins during her time in medical school. She says many of her fellow students applied to more than 10 or even 20 different programs.
It's a very competitive process. Being an international medical graduate, you have less chances to be accepted because the priority would be for U.S. graduates. Having said that, it's not impossible. All what you need to do is basically early planning.
Planning is highly important for foreign students seeking admission to U.S. medical schools. Paul White is the director for medical school admissions at Johns Hopkins. He says some schools do accept students with undergraduate degrees from their home countries. But most, he says, require U.S. study.
So we say we want to see at least 1 year of additional coursework in any area in the U.S. just so we can see the kinds of courses they are capable of taking and how well they may perform in those courses. And there's no question that if they do well in the U.S. and they do well on the medical college admissions test, then they'll be eligible for admission.
I'm Pete Musto.
Now, here's Ana Mateo with Words and Their Stories.
On this program, we explore the origins and uses of common words and expressions in American English. Today, we talk about a word that is a feeling as well as a place. That word is home. Long ago, in the 1700s, home was used as a verb, meaning to be guided to a destination. So when you home in on something, you get closer to your target. For example, you could say, "Police are homing in on the suspects." That is also where we get homing pigeons, pigeons that can find their way home after being released. But today, home is more often used as a noun, and it has a very emotional connection for American English speakers. You can remember the meaning of the word by the expression, "Home is where the heart is." That expression means home is anywhere you feel love and comfort. It is a place where you belong, and often a place you consider your origin. You can also simply carry the feeling of home with you. That is, a feeling of love and loyalty to your family and places that are dear to you. In other words, home is not simply a building where you live. That's a house. There is a big difference between a house and a home. Writer Lord Byron expressed this thought in his long poem, Don Juan.
He entered in the house, his home no more. For without hearts there is no home, and felt the solitude of passing his own door without a welcome.
Simply said, a house is not a home. Another writer, Thomas Wolfe, had a different idea about home. In 1940, his book, You Can't Go Home Again, was published. This title has worked its way into the English language. We use it to mean that the ideas and feelings you had as a child often change when you are an adult. So even if you return to the place where you grew up, time and distance have changed your perspective. You may not be able to recreate even your closest relationships. Rock and roll singer Jon Bon Jovi does not agree with this expression. In this song, he and Jennifer Nettles sing, "Who says you can't go home?" What they mean is, yes, you can go back to your childhood home and be perfectly happy. This is especially true if you've become successful and have made a lot of money. Some people find that returning to a childhood place brings only joy and delight. When these people return to their childhood homes, they may say, "Home, sweet home." Of course, you can say this anywhere. A single woman living alone in her first apartment may come home after a tough day at work and sigh, "Ah, home, sweet home." If she loves her apartment, she might also say, "There's no place like home." "There's no place like home" is a famous line repeated over and over by the character of Dorothy in the classic American film, The Wizard of Oz.
And think to yourself, there's no place like home. There's no place like home.
There's no place like home.
She learns that she did not need to leave her home in order to find what she was seeking. Dorothy's adventures ended right back in Kansas, where she was from. But what about those people who must stay away from their homes for a long time? They still want to feel connected to a place they can depend on. Hotels know this about travelers. Many advertise that they will be a home away from home. This expression describes a place where everything is familiar and comfortable. Friends can also give you a home away from home. When you visit them, they may say to you, "Make yourself at home." This common expression means someone wants you to feel relaxed and welcome. However, let's say you make yourself too at home. You eat everything in the refrigerator. Your friend then may say, "I'm happy to have you stay, but please don't eat me out of house and home." Sometimes when we travel for a long time, especially if we are in a strange place, we can begin to feel sad. We miss our friends, family, and usual environment so much that we become homesick. Some people become so unsettled when they are away from home that they quit leaving the house altogether. They become homebodies. A homebody usually prefers to do things quietly around the house, such as cook or knit, or sit by the fire reading a book. For a homebody, going out night after night or visiting a busy city for a long period of time would be a nightmare. But you don't have to be a homebody to relax and enjoy a peaceful moment, no matter where you are. For example, let's say you have been working on a stressful assignment for a year. Now the work is almost done. You can say you are in the home stretch. This expression comes from horse racing. Horses in the home stretch are near the finish line. So if you are in the home stretch of a very long project, you are almost finished. In fact, we are in the home stretch of this episode of Words and Their Stories. We are at the last paragraph. And now we bring it on home with another song about home. That is something musicians say when they are finishing a performance. I'm Anna Mateo.
this is home.
Now, we present The Making of a Nation. This week in our series, we look at the presidential election campaign of 1952. President Harry Truman decided not to seek re-election. The continuing war in Korea and economic problems at home had cost him the support of many Americans. His Democratic Party needed a new candidate for president. In the spring of 1952, Harry Truman offered his support to Adlai Stevenson. Stevenson, however, said he was not interested in any job except the one he had as governor of Illinois. Someone asked what he would do if the Democratic Party chose him anyway as its presidential candidate. Stevenson jokingly answered that he would have to shoot himself. So President Truman and other party leaders discussed different candidates. Each one, however, seemed to have some political weakness. The Republican Party was also discussing possible candidates. It was much easier for the Republicans to choose. Earlier, General Dwight Eisenhower had said he would be interested in running for president. Eisenhower was the highly respected commander of Allied forces in Europe during World War II. Many members of both parties supported Ike, as he was popularly known. Eisenhower agreed to campaign as a Republican. His closest competitor for the Republican nomination was Robert Taft. Taft was a senator from Ohio and the son of a former president, William Howard Taft. Senator Taft had strong support among Republicans for his conservative positions, but he did not receive enough votes at the party's national convention to defeat Eisenhower for the nomination. In his acceptance speech, Eisenhower told the delegates,
"Ladies and gentlemen, you have summoned me on behalf of millions of your fellow Americans to lead a great crusade for freedom in America and freedom in the world. I know something of the solemn responsibility of leading a crusade. I take up this task, therefore, in a spirit of deep obligation, mindful of its burdens and of its decisive importance. I accept your summons. I will lead this crusade."
Eisenhower chose Senator Richard Nixon of California as his running mate for vice president. Nixon was known for strongly opposing communism.
"I am holding in my hand a microfilm of very highly confidential secret State Department documents. These documents were fed out of the State Department over 10 years ago by communists who were employees of that department and who were interested in seeing that these documents were sent to the Soviet Union, where the interests of the Soviet Union happened to be in conflict with those of the United States."
Earlier, as a member of the House of Representatives, Richard Nixon had led the investigation of a former State Department official, Alger Hiss. Hiss was accused of helping to provide secret information to the Soviet Union. He denied the accusation and was never charged with spying. But he was tried and found guilty of lying to a grand jury and was sentenced to prison. Democrats opened their presidential nominating convention in Chicago, Illinois, 10 days after the Republicans closed theirs in the same city. Illinois Governor Adlai Stevenson welcomed the delegates but still seemed like he did not want to run for president. That only made the delegates want him even more. They were unable to choose a nominee on the first two votes. Then, on the third vote, a majority of the delegates chose Adlai Stevenson, and he accepted. He urged Democrats to campaign with honor.
Let's talk sense to the American people. Let's tell them the truth, that there are no gains without pains, that we are now on the eve of great decisions, not easy decisions, like resistance when you're attacked, but a long, patient, costly struggle which alone can assure triumph over the great enemies of man, war, poverty, and tyranny, and the assaults upon human dignity, which are the most grievous consequences of each.
A political observer described the differences between Adlai Stevenson and Dwight Eisenhower this way. Stevenson was a man of thought. Eisenhower was a man of action. The Republican Party hired an advertising agency to design a campaign to sell Eisenhower and Nixon to the American public.
The man from Abilene, out of the heartland of America, out of this small frame house in Abilene, Kansas, came a man, Dwight D. Eisenhower. Through the crucial hour of historic D-Day, he brought us to the triumphant peace of VE Day. Now another crucial hour in our history. The big question.
General, if war comes, is this country really ready?
It is not. We haven't enough tanks for the fighting in Korea. It is time for a change.
The nation, haunted by the stalemate in Korea, looks to Eisenhower. Eisenhower knows how to deal with the Russians. He has met Europe's leaders, has got them working with us. Elect the number one man for the number one job of our time. November 4th, vote for peace. Vote for Eisenhower.
Adlai Stevenson was known as an intellectual, an egghead. He dismissed some traditional political advisors and replaced them with fellow eggheads when he launched his campaign. The biggest issue in the 1952 campaign was communism. Stevenson said America needed to guard against it. Yet, he repeatedly criticized the actions of Senator Joseph McCarthy. For years, the senator from Wisconsin had been denouncing government officials and others as communists. Eisenhower did not criticize McCarthy. Even when the senator accused Eisenhower's good friend and fellow World War II hero, General George Marshall, of being a traitor. The Republican campaign went smoothly until Nixon faced a campaign finance dispute. The vice presidential candidate was under pressure to withdraw. That led to Nixon's famous Checkers speech. He made the speech on national television on September 23, 1952. In it, he denied any wrongdoing. He defended his actions regarding the disputed funds and his decision to keep a special gift from a political supporter.
One other thing I probably should tell you, because if I don't, they'll probably be saying this about me too. We did get something, a gift, after the election. A man down in Texas heard Pat on the radio mention the fact that our two youngsters would like to have a dog. And believe it or not, the day before we left on this campaign trip, we got a message from the Union Station in Baltimore saying they had a package for us. We went down to get it. You know what it was? It was a little Cocker Spaniel dog in a crate that he'd sent all the way from Texas. Black and white, spotted. And our little girl, Tricia, the six-year-old, named it Checkers. And you know, the kids, like all kids, love the dog. And I just want to say this right now, that regardless of what they say about it, we're going to keep it.
The speech was a major success. many Republicans voiced support for Nixon to stay on as Eisenhower's running mate. And Eisenhower agreed. A few weeks before the election, Eisenhower made a powerful speech. He talked about ending the war in Korea.
Now, where will a new administration begin? It will begin with its president taking a firm, simple resolution. That resolution will be to forego the diversions of politics and to concentrate on the job of ending the Korean War until that job is honorably done. That job requires a personal trip to Korea. Only in that way could I learn how best to serve the American people in the cause of peace. I shall go to Korea.
Hadley Stevenson also gave a powerful speech before the election. In it, he told of seeing an America where no man fears to think as he pleases or say what he thinks. An America where no man is another's master, where no man's mind is dark with fear. Hadley Stevenson spoke of a nation at peace with the world, an America as the horizon of human hopes. Americans voted in November. Eisenhower won almost 34 million votes. That was more than any other presidential candidate had ever received. Stevenson won about 27 million votes. Dwight Eisenhower was sworn in as America's 34th president in January of 1953. He was 62 years old. Many problems awaited the new Republican president. Republicans had only a small majority in Congress. Many of them were very conservative and unlikely to support many of Eisenhower's programs. The cost of living in America was rising. Senator Joseph McCarthy was still hunting communists, and the war was still being fought in Korea. But Ike had a lot of experience serving his country. Dwight Eisenhower came from a large family in Abilene, Kansas. They did not have much money. He received a free university education when he was appointed to attend the United States Military Academy at West Point in New York State. He remained in military service for many years. He was a top Army officer by the time the United States entered World War II in 1941. In June of 1944, he led the Allied D-Day invasion of Europe. In 1950, President Truman named him Supreme Commander of NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. When Dwight Eisenhower ran for president, supporters shouted, "I like Ike." People liked him because he always seemed calm under pressure. As president, one of the first pressures he would have to deal with was the continuing war in Korea.
That will be our story tomorrow. This Making of a Nation program was written by David Jarmul, Steve Ember, and Gerilyn Watson. It was presented and produced by Steve Ember, and we thank them all. Well, that's our program for today. We hope it has informed and entertained you, and has helped you learn everyday American English. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz, reporting from Washington. For all of us here at VOA Learning English, thanks for spending some time with us today. I hope you'll join us tomorrow for another Learning English program from the Voice of America.